Today's interview brought to you in part by Blue Microphone's Yeti Blackout, the ultimate professional USB microphone. Welcome to the show, Steve, and thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Well, thanks for having me. This is quite an unexpected treat.
We're going to get into Deep Purple in a little bit, but before we get rolling, we'd like to send some well wishes and some healing vibes to Ian.
Oh, thank you. Ian Pace seems to be doing very well, and in fact, we just had a show last night that went fantastic.
Well, let's go ahead and start at the beginning and tell us, who were some of your early influences, and what first intrigued you to become a musician?
Oh, good question. I think as a kid, I was interested in everything, you know, from making balsa wood gliders, playing baseball, and doing wheelies on my bicycle, you know, everything. And, you know, playing music was just one of those things. And as a kid, the guitar was appealing because, you know, it's like drums. You can thrash it, right? And kids love that. I think hearing the Beatles and the Rolling Stones really sort of opened my eyes to the fact that it wasn't just a pretty instrument, too. You know, you could use it to make rock and roll. And so that was perfect for the time in my life that I was, finally interested in playing the guitar.
Well, now, do you happen to remember the first album you ever purchased?
Yeah, back then, albums were, my household was a little different. My dad was a minister. And we didn't have any pop music, especially no rock and roll. And I think they sort of changed a little bit and started to realize, hey, these kids, you know, they like this Beatles band. And the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan, which is a family show. There doesn't seem to be anything really bad in the lyrics, you know. So it sort of helped win them over. So our first record was a co-op between me and my brother, my older brother, and we bought a four-song EP of Beatles before the album.
Well, now, when you formed your first band and all that, were your parents pretty supportive about it?
Yes, they were. They're great parents, and there's no doubt about it. They suffered tremendously. My brother was the drummer. I was the guitarist, and we made an amp with my father's Heath kit, you know, record player amplifier. I'm sure they were really sorry that they allowed me to do that. You know, but I had to put it back each time. And I got comfortable with, you know, undoing connections and reconfiguring things. And in that sense, it was kind of neat. And when I did get an actual guitar amplifier, I was in awe and amazement, you know, that I finally had, you know, one of those things that real bands used.
Were you self-taught or did you take lessons?
Both. My first lessons were $1.50 each, and there was about 10 other people in the room. We sat in a circle. The instructor went around and tuned everybody's guitar. It tuned everybody's guitar for the first lesson. And when he came to mine, he says, "You can't play this guitar." I said, "I know. That's why I'm here." He said, "No, you can't play this guitar because it was the neck was too bent. You know, it was really a crummy guitar, and it was cracked and it was about to break in half." It was a hand-me-down that I'd gotten from my grandmother. And so I rented an acoustic guitar for the first year. That, you know, my lessons were just hear these chords to this song. And they would write out the words and the chords. And it didn't take long for me to figure out, you know, I can do that. I want to learn some more stuff. So I started to break off a little bit, you know, do the private lessons. for a little bit, and then I said, you know what, I had to mow like 20 lawns. And during that time, I think I could have learned two or three songs instead of one at the lesson. So, you know, that I went on to be self-taught, you know, for, I guess, time and economic reasons.
Once you really got into it, how many hours a day were you practicing?
It varied. At the beginning, I was on and off like a lot of kids are with things. But when I got to my teens, 13, 14, 15s, it was a passion. You know, in the day, I would sometimes even wake up early before I had to go to school and practice. Yeah, there's always something to discover, especially with, you know, having a tape recorder. I could listen to tapes of other people's music and record myself playing stuff and listen back to it. And so I got really interested in just in improving on the guitar and learning more stuff.
Now, do you happen to remember the first time you ever performed in front of people?
Yes, I think I was almost 11. I just learned to play guitar not too long ago, but we had a music class, and one of the things that they did in public schools was get you to perform as a group, and, you know, and torture the parents by making and it was one of those concerts, and there was a cowboy song, and the teacher was strumming an auto harp. You know, I could see the chords. Everybody had a little music book that they were singing from, and the music teacher noticed that I started learning guitar and strumming, and she was kind enough to ask me if I wanted to try to accompany the group. And I thought, that'd be great, yeah. I think those are the same chords, you know. It was literally a three-chord song. It was not much to it. You know, it was kind of neat. I got to, you know, play the gig.
Let's move forward a little bit. And how did you guys go about getting your original recording contract?
Andy and I took a trip from Augusta, Georgia, up to New York. And I'd recently become a new private pilot and was renting this old dilapidated airplane for the summer for almost nothing. And the reason for that was apparently the guy knew it was about to fall apart. We took it on this trip. We took our demo album, you know, had two boxes of them in the back, you know, and just little, you know, a duffel bag each, and just went up to New York. And we got stopped by weather in New Jersey, then took a bus. Meanwhile, the plane had all kinds of problems, which would be another story. Anyway, when we got to Manhattan, Rod Morgenstein lived up there, our drummer from the Dregs. He put us up and got us rides and drove with us. We went to all these record companies and management companies, pretty much everybody that we'd ever heard of. You can imagine what happened, you know. The albums got sent back with rejection letters, and I shrink-wrapped the albums, and most of the time, the albums came back with the shrink wrap still intact, with the thing, you know, with the letter saying that it's not what they're looking for. You know, don't call us, we'll call you. It was disheartening, but I remember I had a wall filled with these rejection letters, and I would just keep putting them up on the wall. Down the line a little bit, we were playing in Nashville, opening up for somebody at the Exit Inn, just a little nightclub that was kind of, you know, famous for being a stop on many bands' tours. And the Allman Brothers were just finishing a tour, and they stopped there, you know, just to hang out and, you know, hear some music. And Chuck LaBelle and Twiggs Linden, one of the roadies from the band, very, very bright guy, they listened to the show, and when they got back to Macon, they said, by the way, you should check out this band. And so later on, I got another news that Capricorn was interested, and I looked up on the wall, and I said, well, they already rejected us. And before that, MCA got interested from possibly the same kind of thing, because we had been playing, opening up for Al Cooper. Not Alice Cooper, but Al Cooper. You know,
Mike Bloomfield and Al Cooper.
Yes, thank you. And so he got us a deal, proposed deal with MCA. Although it was, you know, as deals go, it was like one of the, you know, the lowest possible paying ones in the history ever. I mean, I don't think there's ever been a worse deal put on paper. But in fact, it was so bad. How bad was it? It was so bad that we rejected it. You know, like, as kids, we knew. They said, come on, man. Yes, we won a record contract, but that's there's no way out of that one, you know? And so the Capricorn one was more interesting to us, partly because we were from Georgia. We felt like we had more of a kinship. You know, the whole deal was more like an entry-level record deal. You know, nothing you're going to make any money off of, but it could turn out to be something nice. I generally give the most credit to Twigs and Chuck Rebell and the Allman Brothers for giving us that little push over the edge with Phil Walton.
When you're getting those rejection letters, not just you specifically, but in general, how do you keep pushing forward so that this isn't just a weekend hobby? When do you decide, this is my profession, I'm going to make a living at this, and how do you go forward?
I love this question, and I hope I'm not using too much time. I love the fact you asked that. First of all, you need feedback. If the only feedback we relied on was from the industry, you know, I'd be a master plumber right now. Or maybe just a full-time pilot. I don't know what I would be, but I wouldn't have been a musician. However, we relied on the feedback from the audience, and sometimes from random audiences. We played gigs for free a lot. And one thing that I did was watch the people. What stops them? What makes them interested? What are the things they seem to lose themselves in and start to, you know, unconsciously move to the music and you know, elbow each other and laugh and smile? That was the whole thing. I said, there's something about what we're doing. It's not going to be mainstream, but there's something about it that people like. We know there's a place for us. We just got to figure out how to get there. We just kept on, you know, the way the stubborn people do.
Let's skip ahead about 40 years. How did Flying Colors come together? And for the listeners who might not know, tell them the other members featured in the lineup.
The first connection for me was Neil Morse. Same last name, Morse. M-O-R-S-E, spelled the same, but we're not related. All these years since Neil Morse's writing with, you know, from Spock's Beard on and all his solo stuff, I'd heard a lot about him and heard his music, you know, sort of admired the guy from afar. Through mutual friends had said, you know, we should get together and do something, you know, sometime. Bill Evans was talking to me. Bill Evans, he's the executive producer of Flying Colors. He's one of these, like, inquisitive, always thinking outside of the box kind of people. And he suggested, you know, why don't you do this project, do something with Neil Morse, and maybe have some vocals in it, you know, where you, you know, it's make it a little bit more appealing to more people, but as much intensity and musicality as you can fit in. And so I said, well, I mean, that sounds fine. It's all, you know, it's all talk until we... So Neil and I got together, did some writing in a day and a half, and it was super productive. Just every moment there was great stuff coming out. And we had, I don't know, over an hour's worth of rough recordings to start with. And we talked more after he went back to Nashville. We talked more about it. It seemed like we were both into doing this. Let's give this a try. So he had Mike Portnoy, the drummer. And Mike, of course, came from Dream Theater, you know, had done a lot of work. In fact, right around that time with Avenged Sevenfold, and just Mike's a very incredibly talented, eclectic drummer who loves to just stretch and always go in new directions and try different things, and certainly has been in lots of bands, lots of groups. And he told me about how well he worked with Mike. I knew Mike because we toured with Dream Theater. And I said, well, you know, Dave LaRue, bass player from a lot of the recent dregs, all of the Steve Morse band stuff in the last 30 years or so. I said, Dave could play anything, and he knows when to talk and when to just play. He's great to work with us. And so we had 4 out of 5 already. And all of us got together and talked about some vocals and the different, you know, what everybody wanted. We all wanted a strong songwriter that was also a singer, as opposed to a, you know, flamboyant performer only. Mike Portnoy suggested Casey McPherson. Case was in a band at the time, Alphabet. In fact, he still is in Alphabet. He had some hits like on VH1, and just a, you know, really a little bit more mellow of a singer than I would have thought at first. But when we got together and did like our trial period, it was so productive. We just kept on going, and you know, in 9 days we had enough stuff for the first album. So Casey was a great fit. And he helped us because being younger than us, he was the one who would say, well, this sounds really good and everything, but it kind of sounds old-fashioned to me. So I want to change it. And like everybody, oh, God, all right. And so, you know, trying to satisfy everybody in the group with every piece was the goal. And that's, I think that's what gave the band its personality.
Tell us a little bit about your songwriting style. Do you start out with, you know, a melody or lyrics, or does it just kind of go back and forth?
There's no one way. For instance, sometimes it might be a song. You know, Morse writes a lot of songs, you know, completely, you know, like on acoustic or on piano, and brings in the song and sings it. He knows when he does that, that the song is in some ways going to be unrecognizable when it's done. That's one approach, and you know, it's like a bunch of wolves, you know, attacking a baby caribou. It's quick and sort of frenzied, but the ideas just come from all directions, and the song changes very quickly. In fact, another approach is start with just a germ of an idea, and same thing, you know, ideas come from all directions, and very quickly we have a song. I brought in one of my favorite instrumental pieces with a melody that I thought could be sung. It was a matter of minutes before Casey said, hey, I got that other part. Remember we were doing a sound check? And he sang it. I said, that fits great, man. I don't know. There's different ways that it can happen for sure, but I guess the main thing is that if you bring in a song, it's going to get torn to pieces. And I keep telling them, don't bring in a whole song. They keep doing it. But we keep what we like and add other things. One time we were, Casey and I were working on a chorus that was already set. Neil got up to get a coffee or something. By the time he came back, we had changed the chorus into something totally different. And Casey was like, yeah, I like this a lot better. This is going to be great. And we were running through it, and Neil walked in with coffee, you know, raised his lips, and he said, hey, what happened to my chorus? I said, get a coffee, lose a chorus.
Are there any plans to record any future albums?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, in just a few months, we'll be meeting for our first round, album 3.
Now, of the first 2 studio albums, do you have a favorite?
No, I think they're different. In a way, the first album is the most magical because nobody knew what to expect. Everything was just a surprise. And on the second album, there are some things like Peaceful Harbor that are just, to me, sort of emotionally intense at a level that we didn't have on the first album. So they both have their, you know, amazing qualities.
Once an album is recorded and packaged and ready for the consumer, do you ever listen to it again?
We do. As we get the, here's the mix, you know, mix number 5 or mix number 3 or whatever, and here's the sequence, you know, here's Mike's sequence. Mike almost always does the sequences. And here's Mike's sequence with the mastering done. You know, mastering it would be the final EQ and compression or whatever to make the songs sound like they all fit together technically. You know, everybody approves those. That, sometimes that's the last time that I listen all the way through it, partly because, you know, the next thing is, what can I come up for this other thing? You know, I'm always writing for something else. So it's like sending your kid off to college and, you know, you miss it, but, you know, you got to get up for work the next day.
Let me ask you a question I've been asking the last few artists. With the industry basically non-existent, is there really any benefit to you or any other artist to record and release a full album?
That's another good question. And I think in Deep Purple's case, I floated the idea, in fact, emphatically, that I thought we should maybe just put out one song a month and forget the album idea. But there's, you know, it just ingrained into the DNA of the band that this is the way it's going to be. Period. I could see Flying Colors doing something like that, but you know, not purple. I think at least the people that we meet, you know, from touring and everything, I guess the super dedicated fans really like having the albums and seeing a sort of a culmination of a substantial amount of collaborative work all in one place. You know, that's reason enough to me. If it keeps fans involved and invested in the band, that's definitely worth doing.
Speaking of recording, when did you first cross paths with Bob Daisley? And is there any chance we'll see another release from Living Loud?
Oh, I hope so. Bob was a friend of Jeff Watson. Jeff Watson was the blonde-haired guitarist, you know, with the long blonde hair that played in Night Ranger, you know, doing all those, you know, two-handed tapping and, you know, really good articulated picking. We did a tour when I was in Kansas, in Night Ranger, Kansas, and I got to be friends with Jeff. So somewhere along the way, he introduced me to Bob Daisley. And later on, Bob told me about doing a project with he and Lee Kerslake. Now, he and Lee Kerslake were in the band Blizzard of Oz. However, they had asked for some royalties on the stuff that they wrote, and that turned into a big, ugly fight that ended with them leaving the band and a lead vocalist and his manager, wife, erasing them from the albums, replacing them with, you know, other musicians. So it was very bizarre. But it turns out that they had about six tunes that they were very personally close to, wanted to re-record them. At first I declined because I thought, you know, I don't think, you know, Randy Rhoads would like maybe having his stuff changed or rearranged. Maybe he would. I just don't know. I don't know. I don't want to, you know, be disrespectful to it. And there's a lot of guys that would be able to do a closer, you know, sort of impersonation of what Randy would do than me. Bob said, no, I think let's do it in a new way, you know, a current way. And one of the things I'd like is for you to put your own stamp on it, on these songs, like Over the Mountain and Crazy Train and stuff like that. It seems like, well, okay, that's a cool approach. I like that idea, but I don't know. It just doesn't seem right. You know, I don't want to do a whole entire tribute album. And then he said, well, how about if we do half the album original stuff and half the songs that Lee and I wrote but didn't get credit for? Okay, now that sounds a little bit more like it. That way we could do some stuff that fits our personality. It really came together quick. Turns out Bob is an excellent producer and writer. Lee, as we wrote a lot of stuff as a trio, and to hear Leo's melodies just eerily come out of nowhere. Lee was the drummer. He could just sing a melody that was so, well, it was just perfect. And I said, well, no, I see how this happened. I could see, man, Lee was like the secret weapon. Bob, he was not easy to please, but if I kind of made making Bob happy the goal of our writing sessions, we came up with some really great stuff. Jimmy Barnes walked in just a total pro and just could just write so easily. Finished with the ideas that Lee had on the vocals and came up with so much of his own. It was just a case of, you know, lucking into great chemistry. It was very enjoyable.
I never knew that Lee sang. Does he sing on any of the Uriah Heep albums that he played on?
I actually don't. I didn't ask him that, but he had really good, like sort of strong, deep falsetto. You know, like that's almost always how he would sing those melodies too. In his falsetto. At first, it was like, you know, I remember the first day, it was kind of like, oh, that's kind of neat. The drummer's got an idea. That's really cool. that's a great melody. and from then on, it was like, you know, you hear something in the background and say, what is that? Oh my God. And you turn around and there's Lee just, you know, with his eyes closed, just thinking up this stuff.
I spoke to Bob about 10 years ago and he and Lee got a pretty raw deal.
Yeah. It's a cruel business. And it wouldn't be that way now, because nowadays if somebody's in the room, you know, delivering the ice to put in the ice bucket when a song is written, you know, they're automatically So it was a different world back then, I guess.
All right, well, let's move into Deep Purple for just a minute. And do you happen to remember the first show you played with them?
Oh, yeah. I went to Mexico City, met them all. We got together, had a little jam session, rehearsed a few moments of the beginnings and ends of songs. And that was about it. But the jam session was the main thing that everybody wanted to do, just to see if we had good chemistry and were able to improvise off one another. We sort of grew up in parallel universes that prepared us well. You know, from as long as they were playing, I was playing, but a few thousand miles away. And, you know, jamming and, you know, a similar, I guess, musical history sort of tied us together instantly. And it felt wonderful. And at the gig, I tried to put together my performance based on what I'd heard Joe Satriani do, you know, a few months before, and also with what Richie had done. And so I sort of blended those two guys into one, you know, that I drew off of and then tried to add my own personality when I thought was appropriate. So that's sort of how I, you know, began the first show. The first show went really well.
That kind of goes into my next question, which is, how do you approach performing Richie Blackmore's parts? You know, keeping them true to the original feel, but, you know, putting your own fingerprint on there.
Well, part of it is, you know, in a restaurant, you don't have just one thing. You have a menu of lots of things to choose from because everybody likes different things. I'm aware of the fact that there's a certain percentage of people that are not going to like the choices that I've made, you know, and the ones that, you know, we're sad to see Richie go, are extremely vocal about that. That's been sort of a hallmark of being in Purple, is that, you know, a certain percentage of people are just going to hate you. Not, you know, not just sort of not prefer you, but just hate you. I basically don't listen to them. I just do it the same way I would do if I was playing in, you know, in a bar for 50 people. What can I do in the song to make it the fattest, you know, the most true to the original, and then still have some fun with it? So my answer is, most of the time, I do my own solos. However, there's a few iconic moments that I do pretty much what Richie did on the original studio recordings. Sprinsons and Highway Star, the, you know, the very fast parts and some of the little melodic parts, people know those, they can sing along with them. So anything that people can sing along with, I try to do. And then take it out, do my own thing, and bring it back for, say, a cue or the wraps it all up. Parts-wise, I definitely, if there's just one guitar part, I try to play the part. You know, being me, I can't help but change things around a little bit. So some of that does happen. And, you know, some people like it, some people don't. And I'm playing to enjoy the music, and I'm playing to make it sound the best way that I can. That's my motivation. And the reason for doing that is I think it gives the best show to the people who took the time and trouble and expense to show up at the gigs. So, you know, the armchair trolls and haters that see it on YouTube have no idea. You know, we're doing the show from the heart for the people there. And in general, my reception has been very good by the audiences. First year was not trouble-free. You know, stuff being thrown at me and things like that. Real brutal internet stuff. But it's definitely calmed down. I think people realize, if you want to see Deep Purple, you're going to have to see it without Richie. They're just not getting back together.
Well, that's one question I have down here. You've been in the band for 22 years. Do you have any thought about the older fans that refuse to accept Richie isn't coming back?
Well, like I said, it sort of points to one of the problems I have with the internet. You know, the global anonymity, the ability to, you know, to do a lot of damage to people from a, you know, from a just pop up from a rabbit hole and snipe standpoint. I don't like it at all. I don't think I have a particularly thick skin about criticism because I genuinely give 100% in everything I do. You know, I practice every day. I work on what I do. Some of the stuff is improvised, some of it is deeply thought out. I'm not there to make an idiot of myself or to make people feel, you know, like they've gotten a bad deal. So I'm trying my hardest to do the best that I can. And you know, when somebody blasts you just because you smile on stage, I just don't know what to think of it. I mean, it's just a type of thinking that doesn't compute to me. I'm literally unable to understand it.
You were caught smiling.
I just shrug and shrug. Yeah, I'm one of those people that does not go on the internet to read my reviews.
Continue on with performing. And do you ever get nervous to walk out on stage?
It depends. Like last night, it was 107 degrees when I walked out of my room. By the time we started, it cooled down somewhat. But that's what I was nervous about, was what's the tuning going to be like? You know, how hot is it going to be? It turned out to be not a problem because, you know, it's low humidity here in Turkey. It cooled down, you know, enough to be fine. So, and I'm nervous about, you know, say my guitar tech says, hey, there's nothing we can do. You're getting 103 volts at your amp. You know, it sounds kind of crappy. There's nothing else I could do. You know, the power is all over the place. Well, then, yeah, I'm a little nervous. Like, is it going to cut off? Is it going to blow the tubes? Or is it just going to be impossible to get a good sound? Things like that. As far as the music, no. I try to prepare myself enough to feel ready, but also ready to have a good time. So I think most of my nervous stuff is traveling-wise. You know, if I'm looking at it, you know, a 26-hour trip, I am a little nervous about that because, you know, what if they have the temperature really hot like they do a lot of times on the plane? There's no escape, you know, and stuff like that. That's probably my biggest fear, is being on a plane and having them turn the temperature. Being on stage feels kind of natural, so I'm fine with that.
Well, when you do walk out and, you know, you're strapping on your guitar and you hear that roar of excitement come off the crowd, what does that feel like?
It doesn't affect me personally at all because I've been in so many bands in different scenarios. You know, I've walked on stage ready to play music that I thought was, you know, was my best work ever and had the audience, you know, almost ignore it because we were opening for somebody and it wasn't a good match. And, you know, you're playing in the middle of the day, it's a nighttime headliner and, you know, people are sunburned and tired and the sound isn't turned up very loud because you're one of the openers and things like that. If somebody suddenly, you know, gives lots of applause and I happen to be in a band that's getting it, I attribute that to the band's history and the band's followers. I don't take any of that personally, either way. And there's an element of show business involved that, you know, I'm not a great student of show business. I'm not a big fan of show business in the sense that, you know, I'm not real demonstrative on stage or, you know, I'm sort of keenly aware of trying to avoid cliches and things like that. If you read the internet, I'm sure you'd find something horrible.
You don't have a personality, you know, Steve Morse backstage personality versus stage Steve Morse. You're the same guy.
Yeah, pretty much. Although, I get a little bit more aggressive on stage. And, you know, I've had moments where I've wanted to kill people. One guy was spitting at me.
You're kidding me.
Like a llama. Yeah. This was in South America. That was, it was just repeatedly. Every time I would close my eyes to do a solo near the front of the stage, he would hit me with it. There's all kinds of stuff. No, I'm the same guy on stage. I try to, you know, take your troubles and put them away, compartmentalize them, and get into the show. Just one of the things that really changes it for me is seeing the audience and feeling the audience's energy. They came to escape whatever is going on in their lives. You know, they came here for to be taken away. And, you know, I do want to join in on that. That's something, I don't know if you call it show business or anything. I just call it, let's do this. let's do this together. You know?
A good audience does enhance your performance?
Does. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's definitely probably the biggest factor. In fact, that's what makes a difference between a boring dress rehearsal and an exciting show. It's the audience. Everybody can play their parts, but you put it all together with you know, when you're addressing the people that are your customers, they're the ones that are paying you, they're the ones that are putting the food in your refrigerator for your kids to eat, then it's a big deal. Yeah, I believe in giving everything you got to the audience.
What does it do to you physically to perform every night and sometimes multiple nights in a row?
Nothing much. If at the beginning of the tour, your fingers hurt more because no matter how much you practice, you know, when you're playing sweaty and just pushing harder, you know, you'll sort of tire out, you know, wear out skin and stretch tendons and wear out muscles more differently than you would when you're practicing. So there's always that little adjustment, you know, physically the band is like, oh my God. And then the next day, you know, you warm up a little more slowly and carefully and get ready for the next show. Personally, we used to tour with the Dregs. If we did a 10-day tour, it was 10 shows, sometimes 12 shows if there was a double night, you know, where you do two shows on a Saturday night. That I've always been used to. And in Purple, we're getting to play less and less gigs per week, you know, just to keep from, you know, having 5 pint boxes on stage.
Going back to the question I asked you about how you go from the weekend to becoming professional, all the musicians that I've spoken to that are at your level, they played gigs like you just talked about where they did 5 and 6 nights in a row and 3 and 4 shows a day. Where does a young band get the experience to become professional?
That's something that I'm witnessing, you know, as a father. My son is a really good guitar player and very gifted, you know, writer, and we do some things together, but, you know, he doesn't want to be really associated with me. He wants to, you know, do his own band. I'm just seeing through their eyes how hard it is. And, of course, it depends on, I guess, your acumen at being able to conjure up things. When I was his age, we could find gigs, and they wouldn't pay well, or they wouldn't pay anything, but we could find places to play, at least for free, that, you know, where there would be an audience. Having 200 channels of cable and everything you want on the iPad and the iPhones and the Android tablets, all this stuff has changed. I guess has changed the music business. It's I would say, as a recommendation, to try to organize little parties, you know, if there is a community center anywhere, to just try to do free stuff. You know, put a donation jar and realize you'll get $10 at the most. Do it, you know, every month. Have some kind of goal to perform something new or different in front of people. And I'm not one of these people that takes away anything from young musicians these days, but they, you know, they have better tools as far as the internet to learn extremely technical things, but the price is they don't have that school of hard knocks repetitive experience that does give you a certain something. So things are different today.
Well, when we do come to see you live, tell us about some of the guitars and gear we can expect to see you performing with.
Sure. I use my Engl, that's ENGL, tube amp, almost anywhere I can bring it. And by saying I bring it, I mean the truck and the road crew bring it. Because it's a very large rig with, you know, like a 70-pound head. I use two of those, one for dry and one for effects. I use TC pedals. Their delay pedals are fantastic. I set them for 100% wet, and basically I don't really need to touch the pedals. I leave them on all the time and then control their output with volume pedals. I use the Ernie Ball volume pedals. So the guitar, when I want to hear long delay, I press the pedal that's associated with the long delay, and it comes out of the separate wet amp. So it adds to the signal, a sort of a slapback delay. And I also have a short delay, which can almost seem like a chorus. So when I turn down the guitar and put in the short delay, you get both of that. I also have a TC reverb pedal, which goes through the effects loop, and on a few settings, I use the reverb pedal. In those TC pedals, they've allowed me to create my own sound, and you can burn it into the unit in just a matter of seconds with, you know, downloading it from online. My guitar is a Music Man, oddly enough, a Steve Morse model. It's got 4 pickups. When I do things like Flying Colors or the Dregs or Steve Morse Band, and with Purple, most of the time it's the 3 pickup model called a Y2D. And the 3 pickup model has a a little bit harder top and gets more, a little bit more rock and roll sound, you know, more, a little bit more typical. But I change pickups all the time. And on the YQD, I discovered there was five pickup settings that I used. So we use a multiple switch with five positions and wired those five sounds on the YQD guitar. So there's basically just one switch for all the sounds. And on my four pickup guitar, there's a bunch of switches and it confuses people. And it makes them question my sanity. But it works for me.
Steve Miller recently had some pretty negative things to say about his experience. So I'm wondering what your experience was like performing at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Performing was fine. You know, it was, you know, we didn't have much time. Just as I was resolving a problem during soundcheck was declared over. Things like that. You know, where I didn't get to quite get everything set. That's normal. That's like it, almost as good as it gets in show business extravaganzas where there's more than one guest. You're generally, you know, have to rely on what you know will work. You know, I did the schmoozing and hanging out. It was kind of fun meeting everybody. And I guess the most bizarre part was the fact that they, instead of inducting the band, well, they did say they inducted the band, but only certain versions of the band from the classic era of the 60s and 70s, you know, and that was just weird. Oh, so Steve, you're in the Hall of Fame? No. I thought I heard Purple. Yeah, Purple is. But aren't you in Purple? Yeah. So Purple's in the Hall of Fame, so you're not? No. I played the Hall of Fame.
Haven't you played it as the guitar player much longer than any of the prior guitar players?
Yes. Yeah, and at first they said, well, it's because there was so many years you had to be in the band. And be recorded. It was 25 years is what was being doubted. But then there was exceptions of people that have been in other bands, less than that, and gotten in. But I think it's just one of those things, you know. When I started the Dregs, I never expected to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And, you know, my predictions were correct. I knew I was not headed for the, you know, the center of the listening audience. I am very glad to be able to make a living playing music, and I am more aware than ever of how hard it is for the young people.
You're in Turkey at the moment. What's the mood over there?
Well, we started kind of late last night because of so many security checks on the cars coming in. Can you imagine how many times that's repeated at every event all across Turkey, you know, after these attacks, or anywhere after an attack. So it's like the terrorists win. You know, yes, they totally disrupted everyone's lives and made people, you know, it sort of enjoy things less doing them as a group. I don't like that, but apparently it's just always going to be that way. And we just have to kind of accept it, accept the security delays and accept the chance, you know, there's a chance you take when you're in the airport every day of your tour, almost. I don't know. You know, I don't want to get political or too deep on that. But the mood is, you know, I think cautiously optimistic.
But people came out to the show and had a good time.
Yes. Yeah. Once the music starts, they forget all that stuff. It's just while they're waiting in line and, you know, honking at the guy in front of them to move. The crew's mad because we're not starting on time. And the promoter's like saying, oh, my God, we're going to overtime paying the security, you know, everybody's thinking about it then. But once music starts, everything's cool. And the people here are very, very music-oriented and make a wonderful audience.
I think that's the way to fight it. You might be scared, but you do go out to the show. You do go out to the cafe.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think I try to make the point to people that, you know, we drive to the grocery store. You know, statistics show that we're more likely to die from that, but we're not scared to go to the grocery store.
You've traveled the world many times. Can you share a Spinal Tap moment with us?
Oh, man. What category? We're going to have to narrow it down. Okay, how about this one? Ian Bass and our manager, they didn't want to go on the bus because the bus was going on a long, just ridiculous, like 21-hour trip. We're in the USA. I happen to have my little airplane, and so I flew it to the gig, I think it was Minneapolis or something like that, or no, in Minnesota, and the name, I hope I'm getting the name right, but I think it was Grand Rapids in Minnesota or something. Again, I apologize if I'm getting the wrong state. They were going to fly commercial, and the rest of the guys went on the bus. Turns out when they got out of the plane in Grand Rapids, they were, you know, on the phone talking to the guy who was supposed to pick them up and said, "We don't see you. We're out in front. We don't see you." Turns out they had landed and gone to Grand Rapids, Michigan. It was it's like the show was starting in a few hours. They had to scramble and charter a plane at great expense to fly them over to where the gig was.
That's a good one.
I got more. Okay. I guess my most embarrassing Spinal Tap moment was on stage. I went to start a song, and I couldn't hear Don very well. You know, Don was playing the organ. So I started it, and it turned out I was playing a half step down. We rehearsed it both in F sharp and G. And I think the last we decided it was going to be a G, but I did it in F sharp because we'd done it more times than F sharp. Anyway, so Ian Gillan was over by me. So he started singing with me. As he walked over by Don, Don was a half step higher. So he changed to sing along with Don. And it's one of those things like a slow motion crash, you know, in slow motion, but it's over fairly quickly. You know, I fairly quickly recovered and got on the right page once I moved over and was able to hear Don. That was probably the most embarrassing musical moment.
When you saw the film, did it just ring true to you?
Yeah, I was one of those people that didn't laugh at all. It's only funny afterwards. And, I said, yeah, okay. Why is that funny? The record's not selling and they're gigs are dropping out. But why is that funny? I got lost in a labyrinth trying to get to the stage. That happens all the time. Why is that funny?
In 10 years, I've been asking that question. I have yet for somebody to say, oh, no, I don't have one.
Well, how about this? Here's a good Spinal Tap story. I got to jam with them when they came to Florida. It was fantastic. And, you know, one of the funniest things about that was my then first wife was listening to them. She was hanging out backstage during one of the things where they play a video of the guitar player doing a solo and the other guys, they show a video of them driving off and going to get pizza and stuff like that during this guitar solo because it's so long. They were up in the dressing room like arguing about, like vehemently arguing about arrangements and stuff. And then when they get back on, they're like all goofy and, you know, and back in character. I thought that was really funny.
In closing, Steve, is there anything you'd like to tell our listeners?
Yes. And if you're looking at music as a way of making a living, just remember that it's one of the most rewarding spiritually, but historically not one of the most rewarding in terms of gold in your pocket. However, in order to even have a chance, you're going to have to make it the focus of your life and play from the heart and be thankful for anybody that takes the time and trouble to listen to what you're doing and to try to appreciate it. It's the most direct form of communication there is between human beings, I think, is music. It's international. It transcends all boundaries, and we've seen it. There's no borders to music. So go for it if you feel the calling, but don't forget you have to put in the time and you have to always be sincere with your music.